As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figure that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side, use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie. Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now, but if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish Moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Mary Mate. How's it going, everybody? Thank you for joining us. Remember, you can always go to usefulidiotspodcast.com to support the show and get bonus content.
Including Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness, where we try to laugh at the headlines instead of cry at them, and laugh at the media clips instead of cry at them, and extended interviews as well.
And this week's guest is Ilan Pape. He's a Israeli historian, known as among the new historians, the people inside Israel who gave a radically different picture of Israel's founding, which was based on a series of myths. And Ilan Pape is among those who helped expose that, contrary to what the world was told, what Israel told itself, Israel was founded on ethnic cleansing. And he's personally paid a huge price for his scholarship, for speaking the truth. And he's with us today to talk about the massacre in Gaza, the mass murder campaign in Gaza, in a historical context.
Yeah. So very honored to be able to talk to him. Should we go to the four basic food groups? Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible?
Yes. What do we have for Democrats suck?
So for Democrats suck, let's take a look at this exchange between Abby Phillips of CNN and Pennsylvania Democrat Senator John Fetterman.
But there are some real questions about what's happening on the ground in Gaza, about the really extraordinary civilian death toll that has happened as a result of this war. Do you believe that anything that Israel has done in these 6 weeks of fighting has amounted to a war crime?
Of course not. Of course not. And it's like, let's not forget what Hamas started. They broke the first ceasefire, and then they attacked Israel and murdered over 1,200 innocent women, children, babies, everything, and brutalized it in the most unspeakable kinds of ways. And so that really is the ultimate, criminal war kinds of. This is absolutely an unequivocal attack to destroy Israel. And we must remember that that's how started all of this.
But are you comfortable, Senator, with the number of Palestinians who have lost their lives? 7,000 children, 15 or 16,000 civilians dead. Do you believe Israel is doing enough to minimize civilian casualties?
One death is too many. It's a tragic. I don't value any Palestinian child life any more than, or any less than my own child as well, too. It's heartbreaking and it's awful. But I do fundamentally believe that Israel must destroy Hamas to achieve long-changing conditions that allow for priests to prosper.
Okay, so no war crimes whatsoever. It's very moving and totally unconvincing that he values the lives of Palestinians, because if he did, he would be upset about what's happening. As we can see from this, he's not even pretending to urge caution. Like we have, you know, we keep watching on Monday mornings, that program we do on Mondays live at YouTube and Rumble. We keep showing U.S. officials pretending to urge restraint behind closed doors, doing it as friends would do in a nice way. They refuse to play judge and jury, but it's obvious that they know that there are war crimes, and that's why they're saying they won't play judge and jury, because they don't want to be complicit in war crimes. But for Fetterman, it's not even an issue. He doesn't even pay any lip service to civilians.
Remember when Fetterman was like goofy and likable?
Yeah.
You know, because he had undergone some serious medical issues. He was struggling. People felt sympathy for him, understandably. But he's turned himself into like the one of the top villains of the year.
Yeah.
Before he would have been a candidate for, you know, heartwarming story of the year. But now he's literally a candidate for villain of the year. You know, he was mocking people who were detained outside Congress for protesting the Israeli genocide. He was waving a little Israeli flag. He went to that pro-Israel rally on Capitol Hill, draped in a giant flag. And he just keeps saying stuff like this. It's amazing. It's a real heel turn, you know, like when a good guy becomes a villain. This is a classic case, Senator Fetterman. Right.
Yeah. So very disappointing. And he should just stick to dressing up as a pro-Israel supervillain, because that's what he is. And that's what he looked like when he was wearing that big Israel flag cape. So that's my Democrat sucking.
All right. For Republican suck, let's turn to what's happening on college campuses. And because you have schools where young people are out there protesting the Israeli genocide, the Israel lobby and its supporters are turning to their familiar tactic, which is just crying anti-Semitism. Chuck Schumer did it recently with this like 45-minute rant on the Senate floor about how everyone protesting Israel is anti-Semitic. And now we're hearing on TV constant cries about how Jewish students at colleges are not safe. Now, of course, they don't speak about the Jewish students who are out there protesting the Israeli genocide, because they don't count, but only those Jewish students who identify with Israel. So here is a Penn student named Eyal Yacobi appearing with Republican members of Congress, including the House Speaker Mike Johnson, to complain about supposedly feeling unsafe on campus.
Well, I'm both honored and thankful to be here. I should not be here today.
Yeah, probably not.
I should be studying for my upcoming finals. I should be taking in every moment, every experience as an undergraduate student in my senior year of college. So while I should not be here today, I am. Because 36 hours ago, I, along with most of campus, sought refuge in our rooms. As classmates and professors chanted proudly for the genocide of Jews while igniting smoke bombs and defacing school property.
By the way, just so people know, calling for the genocide of Jews is probably saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Yeah. Or it's saying like, Biden, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide.
Right.
And we've seen examples of Israel supporters pretending as if they're saying that we want Jewish genocide. Yeah. Because a couple of rhymes in there. The syllables rhyme. So.
Right. So it's one of those two.
Yes.
All right. It's either called for liberation with equal rights, or it's an allegation of genocide, not a call for genocide. Okay. Let's go back to this very aggrieved student.
The neighboring university's president immediately released a statement describing this as a brazen display of anti-Semitism. He went on saying, "Silence in the face of last night's demonstration of anti-Semitism and hate near our doorstep is not an option for me." Well, the doorstep of the neighboring university is in fact Penn. And in fact, Penn's president did choose silence. The neighboring university's president swiftly denounced the incident, and yet our president cannot. Because the glorious October 7th, and you're a dirty little Jew, you deserve to die. Are words said not by Hamas, but by my classmates and professors.
So basically, this is like a glorified tattletale session where allegedly someone said something. And rather than just like whatever, responding to your classmate in however way you seem appropriate, you're running to Congress, the Republicans who control the House, and giving a national press conference. And just, I mean, this would be embarrassing in itself if there wasn't a genocide going on. But there is a genocide going on, which this student and the Republicans behind him are supporting. In the case of Republicans, they're arming it and they're letting it happen. And so right now in Gaza, you have colleges being destroyed by Israeli bombs. All the schools in Gaza, all the colleges in Gaza have been destroyed. People have no place to go. A top UN official just said there's no safe place in Gaza. And this coddled Ivy League kid is whining about feeling unsafe on his campus because some kids are protesting the genocide he's supporting.
And I really doubt that someone said to him, "Dirty little Jew, you deserve to die."
And that's the thing. It's so easy to make these things up. You know, you can say anything you want. And these people do say anything they want to portray themselves as the victims. But whether someone said that to him or not, okay, so go deal with that. File a complaint at your school if someone said something anti-Semitic.
Put him on blast. Put him on blast for being a rank anti-Semite,
But it's like, where's the national press conference for the, like, inside Congress for the three Palestinian students who got shot, including one of them who's paralyzed in the waist down? That's who's facing danger right now. And on top of, I mean, all the like irony upon irony. So you have a genocide going on, yet you're the one complaining about feeling unsafe. Then you have the fact that Republicans are the ones who for years have been mocking college students who are trying to shut other people down because they feel unsafe about their rhetoric.
That's true, right.
This is like the exact snowflake behavior that they have always claimed to be mocking. Except Republicans not only are enabling it, they're giving these kids national press conference. And it's obvious why. It's the familiar tactic of pretending to be a victim so you can victimize other people, in this case, the Palestinians of Gaza.
Also, it's just so rich to see these Republicans standing behind him, nodding, shaking their heads. Like, Mike Johnson is an evangelical who wants the person speaking, the Jewish person speaking, as well as Jews like you and me, Aaron. He wants all of us to go to Israel so we can trigger Armageddon, the end times, and we will be forced to either accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior or burn in hell forever. So, obviously, real ally.
All right. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
So for Isn't That Weird, we have a very interesting video, which is attempting to debunk pinkwashing. Pinkwashing is when Israel hides behind its alleged acceptance of LGBTQ people to whitewash or pinkwash its crimes against Palestinians. Now, same-sex marriage, it's notable, is not legal in Israel. But anyway, moving on, let's take a look at this video.
Pinkwashing is a term that angry, jealous, purple-haired girls like to throw around anytime fabulous gay guys get along with Jews. Call me crazy, but I'd rather be at a circuit party in Tel Aviv getting head than in the Gaza Strip getting beheaded. I love my Jewish friends, and I love my Israeli friends, and I'm going to remind them of that every single day, and there's not one goddamn thing you can do about it. You're in the streets ripping down posters of kidnapped Jewish babies, and your little Yasser Arafat scarves, doing your little Jihad Jane cosplay. I'm a gay guy. I know that if I'm going down, I'm going down with the Jews. That's how it works. First they come for the Jews, then they come for the gays. They had the Star of David, we had the pink triangle. But that doesn't matter to you purple-haired Hamas lovers, does it? Because you're not actually gay? Something tells me if they started targeting my people, your purple hair would turn brown pretty fucking fast.
I don't even know what to say about that, where to start with that. But that thing that he's doing, it's actually very helpful because I was trying to describe and define pinkwashing before that clip. Next time, I'm just going to go, oh, what's pinkwashing? And play that clip. This idea that if you are pro-LGBTQ, you should stand with Israel as it bombs Palestinians, including LGBTQ Palestinians, is so absurd.
It's so dumb for so many reasons.
So dumb.
Just from the point of view of LGBTQ people, Israel has been known to exploit LGBTQ people inside the occupied territories to basically threaten to dox them.
And out them.
Yeah, out them unless they become informants, basically. It's just so, I'm speechless listening to that. Yeah. I don't know what else to say. It's.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, at first they go for the Jews. Okay, they're literally going for the Palestinians right now.
Yes, yeah.
Where's your solidarity for them? Yeah. And you think there are no gay Palestinians? You think the gay Palestinians in Gaza are happy that this is happening? Anyway, that's really an isn't that absurd, but it's also an isn't that weird. Isn't that weird that he thinks this is helpful to the cause? And what's up with the weird angle, like the weird camera movements? That's the least of it, but it's kind of weird also. Anyway, that's my isn't that weird. Pinkwashing. A pinkwashing video pretending that pinkwashing doesn't exist. What do we got for terrible?
All right. For terrible, let's check in with the state of modern relationships. And a woman in Florida had a really harsh response to her boyfriend's wandering eye. Here's the headline from the New York Post. Florida woman allegedly stabs boyfriend's eye with needles for looking at other women. Ouch. A jealous Florida woman has been arrested for allegedly plunging needles intended for her dog's rabies shots into her boyfriend's eye after accusing him of looking at other women. Sandra Jimenez from Miami and her living boyfriend of 8 years had been in an ongoing argument about the man's wandering eye when things escalated into violence, according to authorities. When the pair arrived at their home, Jimenez allegedly seized her chance to teach her boyfriend a painful lesson. When the unsuspecting man laid down on the couch, Jimenez jumped on top of him with two rabies needles that were for their dogs and jabbed them into his right eyelid. That's horrible. That's terrible.
I mean, that certainly is terrible. At the same time, you know, it could have been worse. The needles could have had the rabies, so she could have infected him with rabies. That's kind of what I thought at first happened. So if you're going to be stabbed with rabies-related needles, it's always better to do it with needles that are for rabies treatment than actual rabies. So I salute her for her self-restraint.
Right. It's true. I mean, if your punishment for having a wandering eye was getting rabies, you wouldn't do it, you know? So
right. Not okay.
Yeah. But I'm saying it's like, maybe she's trying to advocate a solution here.
Right. You know,
for the wandering eye syndrome. But anyway, that's terrible. And I hope he's okay. Because even though you shouldn't have a wandering eye, you shouldn't be stabbed in the eyelid.
Right. You shouldn't be stabbed for it. Yeah. She did say that it was a self-inflicted injury, which is kind of amusing. Ouch. Oh no. I poked myself in the eye with a rabies treatment needle. Hate when that happens. And that is your four food groups. We are so excited to be speaking to Ilan Pappe, an Israeli historian and political scientist. He's a professor with the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at the University of Exeter and director of the university's European Center for Palestine Studies and co-director of the Exeter Center for Ethno-Political Studies. He is someone who challenged the Zionist historiography of Israel, as we'll get into in this interview. He also left Israel because his university in Israel wanted him out after he pledged his support for BDS. So he's a very brave voice. He's joining us from Haifa, Israel. He is teaching next semester again in Exeter, but he's in Haifa at the moment. He's the author of several really great books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Modern Palestine, and this amazing book, 10 Myths About Israel, which is very readable and I highly recommend.
All right, let's go to Ilan Pappe.
Thank you so much, Professor Pappe, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you on this podcast.
So many questions for you, but I wanted to ask you about how you became the person you are kind of politically. We interviewed Gideon Levy the other day, and I asked him the same question because it's so rare to find people with your view of Israel and your view of Zionism. And obviously you studied history. I know that that was a big part of it. But can you kind of walk us through from the beginning how your view of Israel changed over time?
Yeah, definitely. It was a journey, first of all. It doesn't happen in one day. There's no epiphany. There's no kind of a wake-up moment. The journey, I suppose, for different people takes different trajectories. In my case, I think it began with the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, because it was obviously not a war of choice, and it kind of shed light on other wars or raised questions of other wars before 1982. And this happened also at the time where I decided to be a professional historian, namely I was already enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Oxford in Britain, deciding both to look at 1948 as the main subject, but also to do it with the supervision of an Arab professor, which kind of course brought into a perspective I was less aware of before I came to Oxford. So I think the formative period was these early 1980s, and it was enhanced by the First Intifada, where it was impossible to demonize the Palestinians as the Israelis did, given what we knew about the mode of resistance and the way it shaped. I would say by the early 1990s, the journey was completed in many ways, and I was already out of the tribe, so to speak, and already persuaded that both my research results and my better understanding through more intimate relationship with the Palestinians created kind of a solid position from which I don't think I withdrew ever since.
And was there an archive or a document that you saw in the archive that was particularly eye-opening for you?
I think it was a bunch of documents rather than one. And these were particularly documents which I think were kind of describing in a very military language what was done or was about to be done to the Palestinians as human beings. So it was this kind of dehumanization that could be, think of an example, an order that would say, occupy the village, burn its houses, expel the people or kill the man. And then it also gives a kind of a more specific definition for men as people from the age of 18, sometimes from the age of 14. This kind of language and orders shook me and really ran contrary to what I was taught or believed about the Israeli army. I think these kinds of documents, more than any others, began to, first of all, normalize the Zionists, because I don't think they are the only soldiers who did these things. But it was more than that, because once you connected the dots, really connected these documents, you could see a much more a more strategic planning of this dehumanization. So it was more structural dehumanization rather than just an aberration here and there. And then I re-understood some of the early documents I saw, like Plan Dalet, Plan D of the Jewish paramilitary groups Haganah. It suddenly, I read it a bit differently than I read it in the first place, as really, as I called it later on, as a master plan for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians.
And for people who don't know what those plans are, could you just give kind of an overview of why you do consider the founding of Israel to be a plan of ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, these were documents that indicated a very systematic plan of dispossession of as many Palestinians as possible from as many parts of historical Palestine as possible. This was a very clear translation of an ideology that regarded the Palestinians as the main obstacle for the creation of a Jewish democratic state, either on parts of Palestine or all over Palestine, depends on which Zionist group we were talking about. That meant that the Plan Dalet, for instance, was a very clear kind of manual for the forces of how to get rid massively of people who lived in neighborhoods and in villages. So it kind of listed very graphically the actions that the troops should take when occupying a village or occupying a neighborhood. The bottom line was that eventually they have to expel everyone and demolish whether the neighborhood or the village, so the people would not have a way of coming back or would not have a place to come back to. And that was a very clear kind of systematic planning that, you know, if you compare it to legal literature or scholarly literature, or even popular literature on what ethnic cleansing means, it really fits like a hand to a glove as a classical case of ethnic cleansing.
And in light of what you know about Israeli history from its start, how does this current moment sit with you? Are you surprised by the scale of the brutality of Israel inside Gaza right now?
Not entirely surprised. And yet I think this is, the brutality is far worse than I thought it would be. I mean, I knew that the Israeli reaction to the 7th of October would be brutal. I have no doubt. I didn't think it would be that brutal. Not only in terms of, which is the most important thing, of course, in terms of what is being done on the ground, but also in terms of the language that accompanies the actions. It's like all the filters that Israel used to put on its explanation for operations have been removed. So a prime minister that quotes from the Bible and saying we will do to the Palestinian what the Hebrew people did to the Amalek, which, as those of you who are familiar with the Old Testament, you know that according to the Old Testament, God gave the license to the Hebrew tribe to genocide to the last baby, the people of Amalek who were sitting in the land of Canaan. So, you know, using that metaphor, comparing the Palestinians to the Nazis, talking about wiping out the Hamas and sometimes wiping out Gaza altogether. I mean, I knew it was there in the background. I thought people were at least aware that this is a bit problematic, even for them. So I was surprised at this idea. I understand it now better. I think what they thought, when I say they, I mean Israeli military and political leadership, right? I think what they thought was that the immediate kind of solidarity shown by the governments in the West, for example, donning the Eiffel Tower with the Israeli, with the colors of the Israeli flag, or donning the House of Parliament in Britain with the colors of the Israeli flag, meant a carte blanche, not only to do what they want, but also to talk about it as they wish, without any fear of being condemned. And I think that explains why they let everything out in terms of operations and the language that describes them. So that was a bit of a surprise. I mean, I thought it would be a bit more tamed, but I think I understand why it happened now the way it did, as I just tried to explain.
I have a lot of questions for you about Hamas, about this moment, about how you've describe what's happening as incremental genocide. But I think it would be helpful before getting into today to talk a little bit more about the history, because as your very good book, 10 Myths About Israel, lays out, this is a case where history really informs the present. And I think a lot of people, if they understood the history, would be a lot of people who aren't already sympathetic to Palestinians, if they understood the history and were exposed to your debunking of myths, would actually have a far different understanding of the present moment. Can you talk about how some of these kind of foundational myths, and not just foundational myths, but revisionist myths of history affect where we are today and help explain the demands of Palestinians?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's very important to put the events of the 7th of October within an historical context. And the historical context at least should go back to 1948. Some people would rightly maybe even go to to an earlier period, but definitely, definitely to 1948, because 1948 was the moment that you, as an historian, you understand the real nature of the Zionist project and the Palestinian reaction to that project. So in 48, it's very clear that Zionism falls into the category of settler colonial movements, these movements of European refugees that not only arrived as Jews in Palestine, but arrived as Christians in North America, in South America, in Australia, and other places. And people who really had to leave Europe in many ways and wanted to create a new Europe somewhere else, but chose someone else's homeland as the new place. And as the late great scholar of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolf, says, in the moment of the encounter with the indigenous people, a logic of the elimination of the native was activated. Elimination that in North America took the form of genocide, and in Palestine first took the form of ethnic cleansing. So I think in 1948, what you have is the historical moment in which the settler colonialism movement of Zionism has the historical opportunity, to implement its ideas from before of how best to make Palestine a Jewish state and how to make it even a democratic state. I mean, ironically, because they wanted so much a democratic state, they needed a demographic exclusivity, namely, to put it in simple terms, Israel wanted to get to its first election in 1949 with a huge, if not exclusive, Jewish majority. And the only way of doing it was to uproot the Palestinians. There was no other way. The demographic balance was such that you could not have a democratic Jewish state. Until today, this is the main problem for Israel. So it begins with this idea that how to make Palestine Jewish and de-Arabize it, if you want. And 48, and I won't go, there's no time for it, but 48 is the moment that this opportunity appears for the young state of Israel to perpetrate the ethnic cleansing. Now, the relevance of what happened there today is in many ways in the last stages of that ethnic cleansing, which created the Gaza Strip. I mean, what people tend to forget is that the Gaza Strip did not exist before 1948. There wasn't a strip. Gaza was a very nice city surrounded by beautiful countryside that enjoyed the fact that it was located on Via Maris, the road from Egypt to the north. And it was a cosmopolitical part of Palestine. Now, Israel created this rectangle, as one can see on the map, of Gaza as a receptor for all the refugees it expelled from the central and south of Palestine. And the last wave of the expellees, or those who were expelled by Israel, lived in villages on whose ruins, actually, the settlements that the Hamas attacked on the 7th of October were established after their ruination. So that's one historical context that I think is important. Then you have a more recent, if you want, historical context. And this is the everything that happened since 1967. 56 years of ruthless military occupation that uses means that are usually reserved to maximum security prisons in order to incarcerate millions of Palestinians in two mega prisons, one in the West Bank and one in the Gaza Strip, through collective punishment, arrest without trial, killing of people, expelling people, and at the same time allowing Jewish settlements to be built on expropriated Palestinian land, who developed their own subculture of racism and fanaticism that is directed against the Palestinian population. And it didn't matter whether you lived in Gaza or in the West Bank. It's one big family. So whatever happened to people in the West Bank affected the people in Gaza. And then we have, of course, the third and most important context, which is the last 17 years of siege that included four bombardments from the air since 2006 on the people of Gaza, one of the most dense areas in the world. People, young people, if you think about it, most of the people who participated in the operation were born into the siege reality. They knew no other reality. They were born into the four bombardments. I don't think if people always understand what does it mean to be in an urban area when F-16s and later F-35 bomb your neighborhood. This is something that you don't recover. Even if you have survived the attack, you don't recover. It's a trauma for life that people can hardly deal with. And definitely Gaza doesn't have in the last 17 years any mechanism to deal with these traumas, and they are added traumas to the trauma. So you have this historical context of recent years and more distant past, but it all together is a history of what I think one can call incremental genocide, not just in Gaza, because for good or for worse, the Palestinians are the worst problem of the Jewish state, and I say ironically of the Jewish democratic state even. And this is why the liberal Zionists are so complacent in all of this, or complicit, complicit in all of this, because the only way you can impose on millions of people the idea that their homeland is not their homeland, and they have either the options of leaving or being in an apartheid system, the only way you can do it is with violence and more violence and with force. And of course, people resist. They always resisted, and they will continue to resist, however the events will unfold later on in the Gaza Strip.
And how do you balance discussing October 7th? Because I know, like, for a lot of people, it's very hypocritical, right? They don't care about violence against Palestinians, and they do care about violence against Israelis. And so there's been a lot of discourse around that, about kind of showing the double standards, the lack of symmetry. But how do you, as a leftist and as someone who has defended the human rights of Palestinians, kind of grapple with judging what happened on October 7th? Because a lot of people don't know how to do it. They don't want to condemn it. I've heard you like praise the bravery of some of the people who took part in that, but also I've heard you condemn the violence. So how do we balance that? I know it's a hard question, but...
No, it's not. It's a very important question. It's not about the historical context. It's about the moral context.
Right.
And the moral context is important. It's important. And therefore, I distinguished between the military operation, namely attacking the bases and the soldiers who are actually the gaolers of the Gaza ghetto, and the bravery of attacking, I think, 8 military bases. And taking captive tanks and so on by these people who were ghettoized for 17 years. And I distinguish between that and the brutality shown either by the same guerrilla fighters or by citizens who followed them from the Gaza Strip, it doesn't matter who did it, who committed the war crimes. I don't think there's any other way of describing what they did in the civilian area. However, I was myself a soldier in the 1973 war. I don't know of any moment where armies behave morally when they are in the midst of a civilian space. That's why I became also a pacifist, not just a leftist, because there's no way within the civilian space that atrocities would be avoided. So that's one thing. I mean, it doesn't justify it. Of course it doesn't justify it. And I think it actually acted a bit of a boomerang against the Hamas, this additional action against the civilians. But more importantly, I think, the moral context, which is important, is to know that as an historian of anti-colonialist movement and of resistance movement and movements against any kind of oppression in our modern times and even more distant past, it's very difficult to find liberation movements or movements who fought against oppression that didn't have these moral aberrations, if you want, these moments that are violation of international law, if you want, or atrocities. And one should not be afraid of calling them atrocities. The issue is not is not only condemning the atrocities, but to ask whether this condemnation invalidates the justice of the struggle. And for me, it's very clear that it doesn't. I mean, nothing that happened on the 7th of October changes my total moral, political, and social support for the Palestinian liberation struggle. There's nothing there that happened that makes me question the justice of that liberation struggle, which is what is important. And I always mention two historical facts, which are interesting, I think, in that context, to understand this moral position. There is the famous massacre of slave owners by Nat Turner in 1831, which was condemnable, of course, but did not lead anyone to invalidate the justice of the struggle against slavery. And the massacre by the members of the Algerian Liberation Movement in 1962, in July 1962, they massacred settlers and their families, French settlers and their families, in the city of Oran in Algeria. But nobody said after that that because of that, the struggle for the liberation of Algeria is unjustified just because you had these ideas. So we can explain why these things happen. We can understand the situation that happened. We can condemn what we should condemn. But to say to us, which is what the Israelis and their supporters in America tell us, you cannot say but. You cannot say there is a context. You remember the vicious attack on the Secretary General of the United Nations when he said that the Hamas operation is condemned, but he wants to understand it was a context. This didn't happen in a vacuum. This is very worrying, because what the Israelis want to do is to use that event to absolve them from all their criminal policies before the 7th of October, and definitely to provide this moral support for what they're doing now. And this is why we should insist on the context, because otherwise you will remain with the pretext. Mainly the Israelis are using 7 October as a pretext to do what they always wanted, regardless of how many people were killed and how these people were killed, right? Which right. is something, actually, I feel much more, I think, morally authentic and trustworthy and genuine in my sorrow for what happened to the young men and women and children that were attacked. Some of them, I know the families myself, I think my sympathy is far more genuine than that of the Israeli politicians in general, who are using that as a pretext rather than as a reaction, because they're so troubled by what happened.
Well, speaking of historical context, I want to read you a quote that I know you're familiar with. This is from Moshe Dayan. He is a famed Israeli military leader. And in 1956, he spoke at a funeral for an Israeli soldier who had been killed by some Palestinians living in Gaza. And Dayan said this, he said, "Let us not cast the blame on the murderers today. Why should we deplore their burning hatred for us? For 8 years, they have been sitting in the refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we have been transforming the lands and villages where they and their fathers dwelt into our estate." That's Moshe Dayan in 1956. So I wonder if you could talk about that quote, and the significance of it in Israeli history. I know it's very famous. He goes on to say, though, that rather than making peace with these people, we need to be even more aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah, this is you have to be an Israeli to understand why it sounds so logical to Israelis to say that the Palestinians have all the right to hate us, to fight against us, even to kill us. And that's why we have all the right to do the same to them. I remember when I just appeared on the public stage in Israel in the early 90s as a new historian, as they used to call me, I gave lectures in various places. And one of them was the Weizmann Institute, where you have these scientists who see everything in black and white. It's very, very difficult to talk with scientists on moral issues. They have this blockade that allows them to do all kinds of things later on to animals and human beings, but that put that aside. They were the most receptive audience I had when in a time when a lot of people I talked to in Israel were very antagonistic to what I told them I found in the archives, either did not believe me or claimed that I didn't understand and so on. So it was very difficult to have a dialogue with Israeli Jewish society. They said, wow, we didn't know all these things. But now we understand that we have no other choice but to destroy them because of what they did to them. I because my mind doesn't work like this, I cannot comment too much about it, but I'm so familiar with it. I'm so familiar with it. It kind of creates a peace of mind in these people, a peace of mind by saying, oh, we understand what they're doing. And well, you know, but let's face it. If you really go a bit deeper into Diane's speech, it was a eulogy on Rui Greenberg, the guy who was killed. If you go deeper, you can see that this is actually a dehumanization of the Palestinians. It's almost like a hunter who would say, I really respect the bravery of the lion that I'm going to kill. It's not a respect for human beings. Because if he really thought that way, at least he should have considered right of return, right? At least he should consider stopping the operations against the Palestinians. But that was not at all the trajectory of his mind, right? I mean, it was this, and we know it from American history. These savages, I mean, yeah, good for them. I mean, they're really fighting for their life and so on. And it would be difficult to destroy them. But we are. We will have to do it, and we will do it. This is something that I would not search for a logical structure here. And I would leave the contradictions as they are, because they're part of that, what I call the Israeli mentality. It's kind of that DNA that is born out of the historical experience and indoctrination that the society goes for. But I think at the heart of it, which is true about every settler colonial project, you have to dehumanize the native and the indigenous. Otherwise, you cannot think big on expulsions or genocide.
It's kind of like the Benny Morris, isn't it? Kind of the Benny Morris line of, yeah, there was ethnic cleansing, but we should have done more, or we wouldn't have the problem we had today if we had done more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not, I wish it was only Benny Morris. Right. From him, I didn't expect much more. But I heard the Dean of Faculty of Law in the Haifa University explaining to me that had all the Palestinians been expelled from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, there would not have been a conflict.
Right.
Let alone that this is not true, by the way, because the conflict, what he calls the conflict, would have taken place in a different form, but it would have still been there. The idea that this is the way to solve the issue by expelling even more people from someone who is dealing with law and international law, is again, if you face them with this astonishment about the immorality of these logical statements, I genuinely think they don't understand what you're talking about. They think they're really building a logical kind of scientific argument here. No Palestinians in the West Bank, no problem of the West Bank, right? How the Palestinians are not there doesn't matter, but they're not there. This is very difficult to deal with because the inner logic of these people says to them they're not only logically right, but also morally right. But luckily they get responses from enough people from the world who challenge them.
Yeah. How much is it that, because what makes, I guess, the settler colonialism of Israel unique? Well, there are a couple things. One is like the anachronistic nature of it, right? Like this happened in a lot of other places, but earlier. And then the other thing is the coinciding with the Holocaust and the exploitation of that trauma and devastation to justify, ironically and disgustingly, ethnically cleansing and genociding other people. But how much easier did it make that, do you think? Like, and did people really think that they were going to a place where what had been done to them in Europe could be done to them here?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a bit more complicated, and it's a mixed picture in a way. On the one hand, the historical timing for colonizing Palestine is not a good timing. It's in a period when the West, or you can call it the global North, begins to talk about decolonization for the first time. At least the left in the West is not at all keen on colonization and begins to see the anti-colonial struggles as something it would support. And so Zionist colonialism appears actually against the run of history, if you want. When decolonization starts, it enhances colonialism, actually. So that creates a problem that is still with Zionism until today. It just takes time for people to understand that. But the seeds of this problem were sown by that historical timing. On the other end, you're absolutely right. What kind of mitigated this problem was the Holocaust. The Holocaust provided the West, even those who were, you know, beginning of thinking about decolonization, like the Labour Party in Britain, that definitely wanted to decolonize the empire, or the left in France that wanted to decolonize the French Empire, to feel that this is outside the story of colonialism. This belongs to a different history, the history of anti-Semitism. And Zionism provides the best solution for the Jewish question of Europe without any need to deal with the Jewish question of Europe. Namely, instead of Europeans asking themselves, not only the Germans, all of those who eagerly helped the Germans to eliminate not just Jews, but also other people, they don't have to deal with this racism because Israel is the answer to anti-Semitism and has support of Europe for that. And therefore, if you want, the kind of sentence that accompanies these ideas is that we are creating a small injustice in order to correct a big injustice. And that really helps Israel. I really believe that without the Holocaust, it would have been very difficult to get the international support for a Jewish state that Israel did receive in 1947. Now, to the last bit of your questions, were they aware of what they're doing? So first of all, also on personal level, being a victim of abuse doesn't mean that you are not becoming abuser yourself. And we've seen it not just in individuals, we've seen it in people as well. But I come back to the dehumanization. The important thing was, and this is very clear in the Zionist propaganda from very early on, the important thing was to dehumanize the Palestinians. And if it doesn't work, and for some of these immigrants who came from Europe were not ideological. So they didn't understand why they had to dehumanize the people who helped them, who showed them how to cultivate the land or share a business with them. They didn't understand why they needed to hate them. In order to overcome this problem, when dehumanization was not catching up with everyone, was to create this connection that we can see also in Israeli propaganda today between the Nazis and the Palestinian National Movement, the Palestinian Resistance, by Nazifying the Palestinian Resistance. And therefore, you can do to them what you would have done to the Nazis had you had the opportunity of revenge. So I think this explains it. The last thing I want to say is most of, at least in 1948, most of the Israeli and before that, shall we call them Zionist troops, that participated in the ethnic cleansing were not survivors of the Holocaust. The percentage of those who survived the Holocaust and became part of the military apparatus that perpetrated the ethnic cleansing was very minimal. So most of them did not experience the Holocaust. They did experience anti-Semitism in Europe in the late 19th century and early 20th century, but they did not experience the Holocaust. And they developed this settler colonial mentality through the 40 years before, or 50 years before 1948, and they already viewed the Arabs in Palestine as natives, as savages, as usurpers who took over a land which is not theirs, and they allowed themselves to think about how best to get rid of them.
In the U.S. right now, there's a lot of discussion about purported anti-Semitism on campus. Congress just passed this measure saying that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. What is your reaction to all this? I mean, at a time when Israel's committing mass murder in Gaza, you're seeing this intense focus on alleged anti-Semitism in the U.S. and even trying to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was historian Ilan Pappe, and how good to hear from him. I really appreciated all of his insight. And a rare, as you said, Katie, before, extremely rare voice inside Israel. The amount of people who are willing to be honest about Israel's past and its present is very, very small. And he is among those who deserve a lot of appreciation for all he's done to enlighten us about the reality of Israel from its very origins in 1948.
It's really exciting to talk to someone who has done so much, I think, to argue for something that should not need arguing, but that is the human rights of Palestinians. And his scholarship, ranging from his excellent book, 10 Myths About Israel, to the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, to another great book he wrote, The Biggest Prison on Earth, is really enlightening, and everyone should read his books.
All right, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. Remember, go to usefulidiotspodcast.com to support the show and get bonus content, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time. And make sure you get that bonus content, because Ilan Pappe provides some very interesting historical background into Hamas. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.